Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum. Celebrate the opening of I Saw It, Francisco de Goya Printmaker, with an evening of live music, art making, live model drawing, tours, and more. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. Info at nortonsimon.org.
What we learned investigating the death of Chicano student activist Oscar Gomez.
It sounds like you ran almost every theory to its end.
Binge all 8 episodes of Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning, it's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Sharon McNary, in for Larry Mantle this week. Coming up at 11, you'll hear 1A instead of Air Talk's second hour. We're giving our very hardworking production staff a bit of a rest while Larry's gone. So we're on the air only 1 hour each day this week instead of 2. Today, a look at the fight in Congress to look at same-sex marriage. That's on 1A. But first, we'll kick off with a federal emergency housing voucher program. The program aims to get unhoused folks off the street and into permanent housing. The city of Los Angeles received more than 3,000 of these vouchers from the HUD last July. They've been distributed, but according to a story published yesterday in the LA Times, not everyone has made it into housing. Connor Sheets is an investigative and enterprise reporter at the Los Angeles Times who wrote that story. Connor, thank you very much for being here. Do we have Connor on the line? Let me just check here.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
There you are. Thanks for being on the line with us. So for people who aren't really familiar, who don't live in the world of housing policy, explain very quickly what an emergency housing voucher is. Like, what's it worth? And once you're issued one, how long is it good for?
So an emergency housing voucher is issued via the Section 8 housing program by the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development. And essentially what it says is that, it's part of a program that was passed last year by the Biden administration. And the aim was to get as many people as possible, in the most desperate situations off the streets and into housing quickly. And the federal government issued 70,000 of these vouchers across the country. And basically what they do is take people who are in the most desperate situations, living on the streets, fleeing domestic violence, human trafficking, that type of thing, and basically gives them income-based housing assistance, essentially a lifeline and a way to be housed.
And is this like permanent free housing for life?
It's not for life. There's various limits. I think it's up to 10 years. I'm not exactly sure of the exact limits, but there's it's a significant period of years, and then that it houses people.
So you said in your reporting that people were at risk of losing their vouchers if they couldn't find and rent a place within a certain amount of time. And you interviewed some very compelling people who told of finding a place and then nearly losing it because in your reporting, the city didn't follow through with its commitment to inspect units or process paperwork. So tell us about some of those situations that you found.
Sure. So as far as the revocation, HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the federal agency, has said that at a future date, they're going to kind of look at the program, see which housing authorities across the country have done a good job of housing people via these vouchers and which haven't, and sort of reallocate ones from the authorities that have not done a great job to some of the ones that have been more successful. HUD would not tell me a specific date of when that's going to happen. But that's sort of what they're planning, and it's in a lot of even the documents before they started the program sort of state this is coming one day. And then as far as the people who I interviewed a woman named Yolanda Robbins. I spoke with a leasing agent in a building in L.A., and so she as well. And Yolanda was awarded an emergency housing voucher back in December. She was looking for housing. She lives in Skid Row, currently has been there about 30 years. And she, she went and applied for a apartment at this building called the Residences at Hotel Alexandria in downtown LA. She was approved for a studio apartment in January. And then, according to both Yolanda and the leasing agent I talked to at the Residences at Hotel Alexandria, they reached out repeatedly to the housing authority of the city of Los Angeles via email, phone calls, never heard back, never got connected with a person who could help them with the rest of the process. And so rather than moving into this apartment that was available for her to use her emergency housing voucher to live in, first time living off the street in 30 years. There was a radio silence from the agency for a period of months, and she's still homeless today. And, according to what her emergency housing voucher said and what they say, like her voucher expired in April. But, after I contacted the Housing Authority of the City of L.A. and relayed this to them, they told me that it doesn't expire until September, and that they, 3 days after I contacted them, they said that they're working to get her unit inspected, which is one of the sticking points, and sort of try to get her in the housing. So
that's one individual. I'm kind of big picture for us. What did you find out about how many of these 3,300 housing vouchers have actually translated into people in shelters and actual housing rental units?
Sure. So the program has some specific terminology. There's a term called leased out. Moved into an actual unit. It's a unit of housing that the agency has made the initial payment towards that housing, towards the landlord. And that's the number that HUD uses to compare different cities. And HUD has Housing and Urban Development, the federal agency, has a data dashboard. We can look at every different county every county, city, housing authority across the country that's received some of these vouchers. And so in LA City, out of 3,365 vouchers that were issued in July of last year, only 196 have been leased out as of Thursday. And if you compare that to, for instance, San Diego's had over 500, the county's had several hundred more. And then, I actually went up to Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo and talked to people up there. And, in those two towns, they've leased out all of the ones that they were issued. And they've actually gotten more because they did such a good job quickly housing people via this program.
Well, we're going to go to the city of Los Angeles very quickly for a response about their performance. But what do you find to be the biggest sticking point in getting people into leased and occupied rental units?
I mean, so the issue is, I think the biggest sticking point is that, as the agency says, that there's a very tight rental market. The vacancy rate is extremely low, the rental vacancy rate. And that's a situation that's happening in a lot of cities. I mean, Santa Barbara has a vacancy rate below 1%. But in LA, I think it's a very difficult market. It's very expensive. And there's a lot of people out on the streets looking for housing, some with vouchers, some without, as Hackler has said in the past, the Housing Authority.
Okay. We're having a little difficulty with your line, but hang on if you will. Listeners, if you have questions about this voucher program, or if you're somebody who's received an emergency housing voucher and want to share your experience, we want to hear from you. Give us a call, 866-893-5722. You can email us at atcomments@kpcc.org and tell us where you're writing from as well. You can also tweet at AirTalk or comment on the AirTalk Facebook page. Also joining me is Doug Guthrie, president and CEO of the Housing Authority of the City of Los Angeles. They call it HACLA. Doug, thank you very much for being with us as well.
Yeah, it's good to join you, Sharon.
It's such an interesting concept because, these vouchers were issued during the pandemic to take the most vulnerable people off the street and get them housed. A year later, it feels like a very small proportion of these vouchers have been issued. Of the 3,300 vouchers to the city, what proportion do you see having been issued?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to this program. I'm glad Connor's on as well. We did receive an allocation of just over 3,300 emergency housing vouchers in July of last year. And as of right now, we've issued the entire allocation of vouchers, which is an enormous lift just to start with. We've been able to do that, get the program up and running. We had to hire 35 staff, get them trained to do this, but we've issued 100% of the vouchers as of July 1 of this year. I think, of course, that's step number one. You've got to get the vouchers and get them to the people in need. And step number two is finding the housing and getting people moved into that housing. And that's what we're working on right now.
In a note, you indicated that 10% actually are leased out, so people, with units for them, and a total of about 22% of those vouchers would include people leased and contracts being processed. One fourth of the vouchers a year into the program, is that really enough?
Well, it's never enough, but it is enormous progress on a brand new program such as this, and with such a large allocation and the complications, of course, here in Los Angeles. So I feel pretty good about the progress that has been made, even though there's clearly more work to be done. But this represents 740 units either leased or in the process of being leased. And the focus is now. We have until September of 2023 to really be issuing vouchers. We're obviously well ahead of that schedule, and I'm pretty confident that we're going to make enormous progress on finding housing and leasing up the balance of this allocation of vouchers.
The population you're targeting, talk about why that makes it more challenging to get somebody with a roof over their head than the Section 8 program that's been going on for decades.
Well, the way the program was set up federally, this is being run through what's called the Continuum of Care. And the Continuum of Care is overseen by LASA for the city and for the county of Los Angeles. So they're the ones that are making the primary policy choices they make all the referrals to HACLA, for instance. Those all come through LASA. And I think, as Connor was saying, the program can address those that are currently experiencing homelessness. They can address recently homeless or at risk of becoming homeless. And the continuum and working with the city and others, the decision was made to focus on those currently experiencing homelessness. And that is this population requires a lot of case management and is clearly the most difficult to house. Other cities and other housing authorities have taken different approaches on this, but I think we've taken on where the most significant needs are here in Los Angeles. It just makes it a little bit more challenging to get that done quickly.
Carlton in Inglewood gave us a call and said he became homeless last year. He's looking for housing for his family of five. He's been living in a van, and it's been very tough for them. If somebody's like living in Inglewood, are there any vouchers left for someone like Carlton to receive?
Well, again, the program is run. We only issue vouchers for referrals that we get through LASA, and that's the case with the county agency as well that does this. And as I said, so far we've issued 100% of the vouchers, and we have well over 2,000 additional referrals waiting if we're able to issue additional vouchers later. So, but you shouldn't stop with just looking at these emergency housing vouchers. Of course, LASA has a variety of tools that they use for temporary housing, interim housing, permanent housing. There are a lot of other avenues to address this problem.
We're speaking with Doug Guthrie, who's president and CEO of the Housing Authority of the City of Los Angeles, and with Connor Sheets. I hope we have you back on a better line. Connor, of the LA Times, what did you find? Why was it so much easier for smaller jurisdictions to get people with their housing voucher recipients into rentals?
I mean, so if you talk to housing authorities in Santa Barbara or San Luis Obispo, you know, these are smaller housing authorities, of course. They're dealing with a smaller population, but the per capita number of vouchers that they got is pretty similar to LA. And then you look at San Diego, which is still the eighth largest city in the country, has many of the same problems as LA as far as high rents and vacancy rates, has a significant homeless problem that it's been trying to deal with for years. So the concept that it's easier for them to get people in, I don't know if that's quite how we characterize it. I'd really say that they, you know, I think the city of LA has clearly made a lot of effort to get people housed. But when you go to some of these other housing authorities, you know, the people that I talked to there have really reported that they were given, you know, help at every step of the way in a way that I don't know is happening in, you know, as far as helping with applying for housing, finding housing, you know, a very coordinated effort between various agencies and nonprofits. And, you know, it just seemed like there's a, you know, talking to people who've experienced that process in those cities that they really felt that they were supported along the way, that maybe meanwhile, when I've talked to people on the street, you know, unhoused people living in L.A., they say that they had a very hard time even getting a hold of anyone with some of these agencies, and that they felt like they were sort of left to their own devices.
Fair enough. And Doug, I mean, we lapse into all this alphabet soup and Lhasa and Hakla and rules here and this agency issues and this other agency administers. So I can understand where somebody who's been living in dire circumstances can easily get confused and lost in the system. And you've indicated that there's a deadline for these vouchers, 2023. What happens if all these vouchers are not turned into leases and shelter for people by September 2023?
Well, as it currently stands, we have to have all the vouchers issued by then, and we can't issue any new vouchers after September 2023. There is a time limit. Once the voucher has been issued, that time limit is 1 year. And so we'll continue to work with people to make best use of these vouchers. This is a complicated program, and it's particularly complicated in Los Angeles just because of the magnitude and the size of the challenges that we're dealing with here. It's one thing even for a smaller community, and I love Santa Barbara, and the leadership up there is terrific, but 50 or 60 vouchers in a smaller community, even in a tight market, is different than thousands of vouchers in a very tight market here in Los Angeles.
Clearly so. And I know that there's some incentives that are being offered to landlords as well. Where do people get in touch if they have units that they want to rent out?
Well, they usually contact us directly, and we'll put them as on part of our accessibility list. We have a number of people working for us as housing navigators, as does the Homeless Service Agency and the providers that they work with. And so we're doing our best to identify housing that is available. We're providing, in some circumstances, even transportation for people to take a look at this housing. At the end of the day, even those voucher holders have a choice. They can decide to take the housing that's made available or decide to keep on looking. And that's, you know, that's happening as well.
Well, I want to thank both my guests. Connor Sheets is an investigative and enterprise reporter at the Los Angeles Times. Doug Guthrie is president and CEO of the Housing Authority of the City of Los Angeles. Thank you both. Coming up on Air Talk, legacy admissions have long been touted as a way of maintaining a bond between university and graduates. But is it really just white affirmative action? We'll talk about the pros and cons after the break.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting an evening in focus, Goya. The museum's galleries come to life at this interactive event, celebrating the opening of the exhibition, I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. Enjoy live music, art-making activities for all ages, live model drawing, tours, and more. Free with museum admission. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Welcome back to Air Talk. I'm Sharon McNary in for Larry Mantle. Happy to be with you here today. Let's talk about legacy admissions. There's a longstanding tradition of elite universities admitting the offspring of its graduates. What tradition I did not enjoy. But that tradition has come under scrutiny in recent years. A 2018 study by Inside Higher Ed revealed that 46% of private schools, including the nation's most elite universities, used this strategy. And why? Well, they ensure an ongoing bond between the university and its graduates, so says those universities. universities. Critics, on the other hand, say legacy admissions overwhelmingly favor affluent white students. Some even call it white affirmative action. This fall, the Supreme Court will hear arguments brought against Harvard and the University of North Carolina challenging their race-conscious admittance strategies, that is, admission policies that take race into account when offering places at the college as a means of achieving a diverse student population. In a twist, though, experts are seeing the fate of legacy admissions tied to this potential decision. If the Supreme Court decides to roll back or outlaw the use of affirmative action, many experts believe that legacy admissions will also come under more intense scrutiny. Today on Air Talk, I'm joined by senior editor and reporter at ProPublica, Daniel Golden. He's also the author of The Price of Admission, How America's Ruling Class Buys Its Way into Elite Colleges and Who Gets Left Outside the Gates. Also with us later is Mitchell Chang, professor of education and Asian American studies at UCLA. Listeners, what are your thoughts on legacy admissions? Give us a call at 866-893-5722. You can email us at atcomments@kpcc.org. You can also tweet at AirTalk or comment on the AirTalk Facebook page. let's start with Dan. I'm going to start with a really basic question, just in case we have listeners who don't know. What is affirmative action and what is legacy admission?
Well, affirmative action is a preference in the admissions process for candidates from underrepresented groups, including African-Americans and Latinos. Legacy admissions is a boost for children of alumni, sometimes also for grandchildren of alumni, depending how it's defined. And so they sort of act as counterweights to each other in a way, in that legacy preference tends to benefit affluent white families. That's where a disproportionate share of the alumni children who get into elite schools, that's their demographic background.
So it took me a little while to really kind of connect the two. What is the relationship between affirmative action and legacy admissions? What do they have to do with each other?
Well, they're both preferences that are used in the college admissions process, right? I mean, people think of college admissions as being strictly on merit, but it's really more like who wants to be a millionaire. There's a number of lifelines, and those include affirmative action, legacy admissions, along with the preference for recruited athletes, preference for children of faculty and staff, a variety of other preferences, development preference for children of rich people who are not alumni but are expected to donate lavishly to a university. So in any, you know, freshman class, you know, not everybody's admitted on merit. A lot, you know, have some merit but come in on the base of these preferences. Now, politically, there's a relationship between affirmative action and legacy preference in that, as I mentioned, they kind of act as counterweights. So in states where you've had affirmative action and admissions banned or restricted, like Georgia, Texas, California, in those states, there's also been efforts, you know, sometimes successful, to roll back legacy preference on the grounds that if you're not going to have a preference for people from, you know, so disadvantaged groups, how can you have a preference for advantaged white rich people?
Well, and the fact that a lot of these elite universities are private institutions, I mean, can't they just do what they want?
Well, they're private nonprofit institutions, which means that they get a large tax break from the government. You know, they don't pay taxes. So because of that, they're supposed to have a socially productive mission. So a lot of these schools will say that their mission is to, you know, elevate people who are very deserving but may not come from, you know, wealthy or privileged backgrounds and help them achieve the American dream. And so legacy preference sometimes runs counter to that. And then in a more practical vein, although they're private, they get a lot of government funding, right? For they get their students are getting a federal financial aid. Their researchers are getting federal grants and so on. And, you know, one could envision a situation where legislation was passed that could tie the provision of this money to getting rid of legacy preference.
So there is a public interest in making sure that university admissions don't turn into just privileged people getting privileges. So how prevalent are these legacy admission practices? Are we talking only about elite universities like Harvard or Yale?
Well, they're extremely prevalent at the more elite universities, not just Harvard and Yale, but any place that is selective. In other words, if it's a college that admits, 90% of their applicants, legacy preference doesn't really apply because just about everybody's going to get in anyway. But once you get to a school that's only admitting, 40, 30, 20, 10% of its applicants, then legacy preference becomes increasingly important. And so it's quite prevalent in the more selective American institutions, not just private, but also public universities. And it's quite significant. Most of the studies that have been done show that it amounts to, at least as much of a preference in terms of, say, SAT points as affirmative action does. And, my own research indicated that legacy preference gets bigger if the alumnus is also a major donor. If you're an Ivy League alum and your kid is applying to school and, you've given the school $10 million, your legacy preference is bigger than if you're an Ivy League alum whose kid is applying and you haven't given anything.
Huh. Well, to our listeners, tell us your thoughts on legacy admissions. Have you benefited from it? Do you feel like it's hurt you in any way? Give us a call, 866-893-5722. You can email us at atcomments@kpcc.org or tweet us at AirTalk or comment on the AirTalk Facebook page. Let's bring into the conversation now Mitchell Chang, professor of education at UCLA. Mitch, thanks for being with us on AirTalk.
My pleasure.
So back in January, the Supreme Court added affirmative action in higher education to its list of things it plans to address. What do you see as the status of affirmative action in California higher education?
Well, in 1996, the California voters passed what was called Proposition 209 and voted to ban the use of affirmative action involving race-based and gender-based preferences. And there was an attempt to repeal Proposition 209 in 2020 through another ballot initiative called Proposition 16, but voters did not pass it. So California has not practiced affirmative action since 1996.
And does it use other means to diversify its its student body?
So here's the interesting story. The second part of the story, there's been a lot of political pressure, especially for the UCs to survey wider range of the California population. So over the last few decades, the UCs have been revamping our admissions practices. And a couple of decades ago, we moved from a more straightforward assessment based mostly on test scores and grades to a more holistic assessment. And during the pandemic, the UCs went test blind. And I believe it was last year we decided to go test blind indefinitely.
Wow. So you don't have to pass some big SAT or other kind of test to get into University of California and the Cal State system?
Yeah, you no longer have to submit test scores.
But it helps if you do, though?
No, it does not. So that would be called test optional. And this is what the Ivy League institutions and other places like Stanford elected to do during the pandemic is move into a test optional where applicants can submit test scores, but they don't have to. And they'll continue to do that for this upcoming year for the class of 2023.
So on the flip side of that, are legacy admissions practiced in public or private universities in California?
Well, they're certainly not practiced in public institutions, not in the UCs, for the reasons Mr. Golden had already hinted at. But I agree with him. It's alive and well in the private sectors, even in California, when it comes to legacy.
So if the Supreme Court overturns affirmative action this fall, and if legacy admissions, you know, peter away with that, what will that mean for admissions in higher ed? What will be the impact on colleges and how they'll admit students in the future?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. And I think what's going to happen is that the overturning of affirmative action and perhaps with it legacy admits will accelerate the revamping of admissions practices across the country, because now we're not talking about state-specific ballot initiatives like Proposition 209, but we're talking about a nationwide ruling. And this will be, I think, very consistent with the long history of revamping admissions in higher education over the history of higher education again. And I think what's interesting at this moment in history is that it will come at a time when the public still has great faith that higher education serves as an engine of social mobility, but the competition to get a spot at an institution that can best advance one's mobility, such as, you know, Stanford, Harvard, UCLA, is patently unfair. At least this is how it's perceived quite widely. So there is great pressure for those institutions that are highly selective to address fairness and at the same time so that they can remain legitimate and relevant to the public. But here's the rub. They must still figure out a way to admit 2,300 applicants from a pool of 60,000. So you still have to, you know, figure out how to go about doing that and select from this pool.
And without test scores in the factor, how does one perceive merit?
That's where I was headed. And I think what's going to happen is that over the next decade, we're going to have a much more rigorous and intense debate about what counts as merit and how to assess merit with the dual commitment to fairness.
We
saw a glimpse of this kind of the intensity of such a debate with Lowell High School in San Francisco, which you know, a year ago changed their admissions practices and was accused of abandoning merit. So you know, how to juggle these multiple interests will be more intensely and heavily debated in the next few years, I believe.
Going back to Dan Golden of ProPublica, besides the obvious reason of money, what are some of the other reasons colleges and universities cling to legacy preferences?
Well, the major reason is money, of course. They think that they'll get more donations if the children are admitted than if they're rejected, and they rely on their alumni for funding, particularly as government support in some cases is going down or just staying the same. But they also talk about yield. You know, legacy admits yield is the proportion of students who apply who, once they're admitted, then decide to go to that university rather than some other university. And the yield among legacy applicants is quite high for two reasons. One is there's a family tie to the university, that the parent went there. And the other is because they're getting a big boost, they wouldn't be able to get into another university of the same quality because they wouldn't be a legacy there. So they face a choice between going to the university where their parents went or going to a university of lesser prestige. So universities like to have a high yield rate. That's one of the things that, you know, various periodicals and other people measure when they look at the quality of a university. And so, you know, yield rate and money in the opposite order, money and yield rate are probably the two biggest factors. And then they will talk about, you know, history and tradition and rewarding alumni who are volunteers and and active at the university. And you know, there's something to all that, but probably not a whole lot. I just want to also mention.
We're almost out of time, Dan. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
I want to thank senior editor and reporter at ProPublica, Daniel Golden, for this discussion. Also the author of The Price of Admission, How America's Ruling Class Buys Its Way into Elite Colleges. Also thanks to Mitchell Ching, professor of education and Asian American studies at UCLA, for joining us. It's your talk on KPCC. I'm Sharon McNary in for Larry Mantle. Coming up, Larry's interview with Grammy-winning bassist and composer Christian McBride, serving as musical director for the upcoming Hollywood Bowl tribute to Peggy Lee and Frank Sinatra, part of its 100th anniversary night at the Hollywood Bowl.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting an evening in focus, Goya. The museum's galleries come to life at this interactive event, celebrating the opening of the exhibition, I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. Enjoy live music, art-making activities for all ages, live model drawing, tours, and more. Free with museum admission. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Support comes from Japan House LA, presenting Yes, Kawaii is Art. Express yourself. Kawaii translates to cute or adorable, yet its influence extends beyond aesthetics to encompass fashion, art, technology, and even social behavior. Sebastian Masuda, the king of kawaii, brings together multiple artworks unraveling the kawaii concepts to foster a sense of joy, innocence, and community as a tool for self-expression and representation. Visitors can step into this colorful world to feel the aesthetic for themselves. May 2nd to November 3rd. No admissions fee. More at japanhousela.com.
Never know how much I love you. Never know.
One of the most classic performances and recordings from the mid-20th century, Miss Peggy Lee. It's Air Talk on KPECC. Sharon McNary's hosting this week while I'm on vacation. But before I left, I got a chance to talk with one of my favorite musicians, Christian McBride, the bassist, composer, arranger, and big band leader, 8-time Grammy winner and former creative chair for jazz at the LA Phil. And he's back at the Hollywood Bowl Wednesday night as the musical director for a tribute to Peggy Lee and Frank Sinatra. Christian, great to have you back with us on Air Talk.
Thanks for having me, man. Great to speak with you.
I'm sure looking forward to Wednesday's concert. I'll be there. I want to start, first of all, I love hearing you describe your formative musical experiences on your SiriusXM Real Jazz Channel show, The Lowdown with Christian. And I wonder, you know, were Peggy Lee and Sinatra playing in your home growing up in Philly?
Absolutely. I will say probably not as much as Nat King Cole and Billy Eckstine and Sarah Vaughan, but when I moved to New York and became a student and like a godson to the late, great Ray Brown, Ray really taught me a lot about some of those singers that I needed to go back and listen to, particularly Peggy and Frank.
Well, and I love you bring up Ray Brown. You had that wonderful recording years ago with Ray Brown and John Clayton, who's a friend of the show, and we're the summit of the great bassists coming together. And another example of how in jazz there is this generational handing down of not just musical approaches, but the history of the music. And I know, you know, you're someone who really loves that history and cherishes it.
It's so important. You know, you can't go forward unless you know where you've been. You know, I find a lot of people always talk about, you know, creating something new, creating something fresh. Well, I think if you find if you really do your history, you realize that what you come up with that you think is fresh might not always be that fresh. Somebody already did it. You just put some new clothes on it, you know? And that's why I've always been so deeply interested in history, because there've been a lot of innovators that haven't been recognized. There've been a lot of ideas that have been flushed out. Now obviously with technology, you can do all kinds of wonderful things now that you couldn't do in the past. But in terms of just, music, just in terms of like what people play on their instruments, what comes out of people's mouths and out of their hearts. You know, this world is very old, and there have been a lot of people who have been doing this for a long time. So I've always been interested in that history.
We're talking with musician Christian McBride. He is the musical director for Wednesday night's event at the Hollywood Bowl, which is a tribute to Peggy Lee and Frank Sinatra, an extraordinary cast of performers, Billie Eilish, Debbie Harry, my favorite singer in the world, the great Diane Reeves is on the bill, Brian Stokes Mitchell, Seth MacFarlane, Betty LeVette, and Gretchen Parlato. It's an all-star cast. You're going to be performing. In your role as musical director, what does that entail?
And the Count Basie Orchestra.
Oh, terrific. The Basie Orchestra. Great. So right. what is your role as musical director when you've got all these people working together in a tribute program? What do you do?
I check to see what songs people like to sing, what songs are available, what songs need to be arranged, if there need to be any new arrangements. I speak with Scotty Barnhart, who's been the leader of the Basie Band for I don't know how many years now, to, you know, see what songs he will conduct, what songs I will conduct, what songs I'll play on, what songs I won't play on. So, you know, it's not that much different than being a referee in a sports contest, because, you know, all of these singers know what they're doing. I mean, you know, you just need somebody to make sure everyone's in the right spot.
And in terms of handling the arrangements, how does that work? Do they often bring their own arrangements, or do you find ones for them, or are there some that are specially done for the evening?
No, we're doing we located, I would say, most of the original Sinatra and Peggy Lee arrangements. So you'll be hearing those original Nelson Riddle and Gordon Jenkins arrangements. A couple of new ones, but mostly you'll be hearing the original arrangements.
That's great. And we're going to hear some examples of that coming up on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by Christian McBride, a tremendous bassist, a composer, arranger, and big band leader as well. And we'll get back talking more about the tribute to Peggy Lee and Sinatra Wednesday night at the Bowl. But I want to take a moment to play one of my favorites that Christian recorded. It's from the Grammy-winning album The Good Feeling. It's the first of his big band recordings, which the Grammy voters have heaped a great deal of acclaim on all of them. This is a composition by Christian, Brother Mister. Listening to Christian McBride, big band from the Grammy Award-winning album of 2011, The Good Feeling, and the track Brother Mister. Christian, tell us a little bit about working in the big band environment, because you have, you know, so many different groups. I saw the group of young musicians you had a month or so ago up in San Francisco. Each of these allows you a little different chance, seems to explore things you like to do in jazz.
Yeah, I guess that's the Gemini in me. you know, I had a wonderful working relationship with Chick Corea as well as with Pat Metheny. And those two gentlemen in particular, I watched how they always had multiple projects going on simultaneously. You know, Pat Metheny had the Pat Metheny Group for many, many years with Lyle Mays. But he always had projects with Charlie Hayden and Billy Higgins or Dewey Redman, Ornette Coleman, or Dave Holland, whoever it was. And Chick Corea, of course, had all kinds of bands throughout his career. Mm-hmm. And I realized that being that prolific is that's a very special thing. You get to keep your musicianship skills sharp when you play with a lot of different people. But also when you're in the position that they were in, you get to employ a lot of different musicians as well. You know, so
yeah.
It's not only good for the creative spark, but it's also good for the business.
That makes sense. We're going to continue with Christian McBride, but let's go to our break with a classic Sinatra recording from 1954, Songs for Young Lovers.
Someday, when I'm awfully low, when the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you. And the way you look tonight, yes, your love with your smile so warm.
More on the tribute to Peggy Lee and Frank Sinatra Wednesday night at the Bowl with the musical director of the evening, Christian McBride, when we come back in 1 minute on Air Talk.
And the way you look tonight, with each word. I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol doesn't thrill me at all.
Right before the break on Air Talk, we heard Sinatra's 1954 classic recording, The Way You Look Tonight, and this almost a decade later off the days of Wine and Roses, Moon River, and other Academy Award winners' compilation. But the original recording, 1964, I Get a Kick Out of You from Sinatra. We're joined by Christian McBride, the musical director for Wednesday night's tribute to Peggy Lee and Frank Sinatra at the Hollywood Bowl. Christian, what is it about Sinatra and the way that he sings these great American songbook and the arrangements that go with them that you think makes them hold up so many years later?
Well, he sang with such ease and such musicality and such emotional authenticity. You could tell that. I think most of those singers from that period, they sang songs about romance and heartbreak and, something about that sort of timeless emotion and the way that they sang them with such ease. It wasn't forced. They weren't trying to impress you. They were really trying to get you to understand the feeling of the story. That's why it's so timeless.
One of the things I love, too, is that at least now, and I don't know whether it was this way in the 50s and 60s, but we do celebrate the arrangers of these songs. And I wonder if you can speak to that point, because to me, arrangers are sort of they're the unheralded people, but that often make the biggest difference in how the recording sounds.
Arrangers and orchestrators, they are the interior decorators. What would a song be without the instruments that are orchestrated so well and so gloriously? I mean, another thing about those great songs from that period, with particular regards to both Peggy Lee and Frank Sinatra, you don't just remember the way they sang the song. You remember the arrangements. You remember the horn parts. You remember the flute parts. You remember the violin parts. You sing along with those parts, and those were the people like Nelson Riddle, Gordon Jenkins, Don Costa, Quincy Jones. You know, these are the people behind the scenes that, like you mentioned, at one point, their names actually did get on the record, Billie Mae, you know, Billy Byers, all kinds of great arrangers. And that was kind of going on into the 70s with people like Oliver Nelson and Bob James. You know, they were great arrangers. So I don't know. Maybe we'll get back to that one of these days.
That'd be great. The late Oliver Nelson, who left us all too soon. But what an original sound as well. One of the things you're talking about, this, I think about how Sinatra did sound different working with different people. One of my favorite Sinatra recordings is with the Basie Orchestra, Sinatra at the Sands. I don't know if that's one you've heard, but Quincy Jones and Bill Conrad Rocky and Bullwinkle, and Cannon does the introduction with that deep baritone voice.
Right.
Classic recording. And to hear him in a little bit more of a jazz setting, it's a great album.
Well, that's the perfect gateway album for someone who is, I believe, a hardcore jazz fan. If you're coming from like the, you know, if you love Blue Note records from the 60s, from the 50s and 60s, and Miles Davis's great quintets and Coltrane's quartet and even fusion from the 70s, you know, if that's where your wheelhouse is and you really want to get into Sinatra and you don't know where to start, that record, Sinatra at the Sands with the Basie Band and Quincy Jones, that's the perfect entry point.
That's great. We're talking with Christian McBride, the musical director of Wednesday night's tribute to Peggy Lee and Frank Sinatra at the Hollywood Bowl. It's going to be a great lineup of artists. Billie Eilish is performing, as will be Diane Reeves, Deborah Harry, Brian Stokes Mitchell, Seth MacFarlane, Betty LeVette, Gretchen Parlato. It's going to be a terrific night. The Basie Band is going to be on stage as well. And are both halves of the performance, are they split between the artists, or are you going to meld them over the course of the evening?
Oh, we're going to meld them. You know, no separation.
All right. Very good. Well, before we close out, let's talk about Peggy Lee, because she, too, was a songwriter, Lady and the Tramp, of course, a signature work with the films that she did and the scoring for the Disney classic. But you know, one thing stands out to me is, as a performer, how Peggy Lee, you know, she doesn't move that much at all, but she is so cool as she presents the song.
Oh, man, Peggy Lee was such a great performer on every level. And you listen to some of those recordings she did early in her career with the Benny Goodman Band, things like Why Don't You Do Right and things like that. And, you know, there's a YouTube clip, I think it's still up. In 1973, Quincy Jones produced a television special for Duke Ellington. I think it was called We Love You Madly. And it was probably one of the first, if not only, television variety specials dedicated to a American jazz legend like that. And so everyone was on this concert. Joe Williams, Billy Eckstein, Aretha Franklin, Roberta Flack, wow, Sarah Vaughan, and Peggy Lee. So what I found so mesmerizing about this show is that, you know, I always knew Peggy Lee from, you know, Fever, you know, that was like her big hit, you know.
Yeah.
But to hear her singing alongside Sarah Vaughan, Aretha Franklin, and Roberta Flack, it was proof that her style of singing and the way that she performed, oh man, she killed it in this performance, you know, and that's what I always hope artists are striving for, timelessness, that you can perform in any era with any person and still sing the way you sing or play the way that you play, and it still fits. You know, that's a rare gift. And also, this is her centennial year, so a double celebration for Peggy Lee.
All right. We're talking about the tribute to Frank Sinatra, to Peggy Lee, Hollywood Bowl on Wednesday night, Christian McBride, who's musical director of the evening. And you could have been talking about yourself in terms of, you know, your voice coming through clearly and working with people across multiple generations and multiple styles of music as well. And let's listen to Peggy Lee. This from the 1948 album Rendezvous with Peggy Lee. Why don't you do right?
Why don't you do right like some other men do? Get out here and get me some money too. You're sitting down wondering what it's all about. You ain't got no money, they will put you out. Why don't you do right like some other men do?
It's Air Talk on KPCC. Coming up next, it's 1A. Sharon McNary back tomorrow morning at 10 for me on Air Talk. Have a terrific afternoon.
If you had prepared 20 years ago, you wouldn't be a wonder now from door to door. Why don't you do right like some other men?
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.